say no more, but I got a little bit more to say. Shaheed, you got to keep it moving, baby. You got to keep it moving. They can't fuck with you.
Up comes a short, sneaky one. Gone with the loaded gun. Shit's all locked till I'm done. Bad little bad.
My name is Debi, storyteller, dub poet, partly raised in Montreal, 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 launching my new CD 333. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Hello, and welcome to Gay and Grey Live on CKUT 90.3 FM. On today's broadcast, we are featuring two edited podcasts from our original series. We will speak with Bobby and Miranda, two members of Gay and Grey Montreal. Bobby recounts what it was like to grow up in the Bronx, New York. He talks of his ongoing journey to better understand who he is through therapy. And at age 17, he travels to Montreal to study at McGill University, and he recounts his first sexual experience and why it was important to him. We also hear part of Miranda's story, in which she shares what it was like growing up in a poor lesbian household, being a person of color in a very white school, and having to hide who she really is. She shares her experience of sexual exploitation at a young age. We would advise that if this subject is triggering, you should stop listening to this broadcast. If you require assistance, please phone the Sexual Abuse Hotline at Santé Montréal at 1-888-933-9007. These are stories of real queer people who wish to share what it was like for them growing up in the 50s and forward. Check our website to access our original podcast series, or search for Gay and Grey Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Welcome to the Gay and Grey Podcast. My name is Bobby. I'm from the Bronx.
You're from the Bronx?
Yes, yes, yes.
What?
Laughter is what that usually is, the typical response to that, which is fine. I mean,
I was not prepared for that. That was my least, like, I was not expecting the Bronx. I think I was expecting that you were from NDG, and I was very wrong, and I'm very pleased to hear that I'm wrong. The Bronx is a pretty fun place.
Yeah, it was fun in a way. It was horrible in a way. And I guess it kind of makes sense in a way that you could have seen me as from NDG, because Montreal has all kinds of ethnic accents, and my voice could be a kind of a Jewish or other ethnic Montreal accent. Well, you know, I've had a lot of therapy over the years. All of it, well, except when I was a very small boy and my parents sent me to a psychiatrist for phobias. You know, it was all, you know, my decision that I was aware that there were problems I wanted to work on. Mm-hmm. There have been times in my life when things have really bothered me. Other times when it wasn't so bad, but I wanted to talk to somebody professionally to try to make it better. So from just about as long as I can remember, well, especially from my teenage years up, I've been looking for opportunities to do that. And, you know, it's nobody can work miracles.
What was it like growing up in the Bronx? How long were you there?
I was there all the time until almost 17, when I went away to university, to McGill, actually. I didn't even know about McGill, and I knew virtually nothing about Canada or Montreal. So that was half by accident. My aunt had a neighbor who had a daughter who went to McGill. And so that was the first time I'd heard of it. And it was very appealing to me. You know, I was interested in French, so Quebec was a natural option. And Canadian tuitions were dirt cheap compared to most American schools.
Still are.
I just thought it would be good for me to get away. And it's, of course, it was kind of interesting to think of going to another country, even though Canada isn't that much different. It still is. It is different, for sure. So there I was, ending up there. And so that was when I was 17.
When you moved to Montreal, what did you notice that was surprising and different?
even though Montreal is a big city, by the way, it felt more quiet. It was slower. You know, New York is New York. Very fast-paced, very hyperactive, very speedy. So that's one thing I noticed right away, that difference in pace. One kind of interesting thing, I never would have believed it, I never would have expected it, was I'd say that at that time, about half the student population in the arts faculty, which is what I was in McGill, was Jewish. So because it was a later immigration, their parents were a little bit more like my grandparents. They loved mimicking their parents' Jewish accent. A lot of them could speak some Yiddish. Like, it was like, what's going on here? And I liked that. That was fun.
What did you study in McGill? You said it was arts. Was it visual arts or theater?
Arts, the way I say liberal arts, because McGill didn't have that. I studied visual arts, like studio art, painting, drawing, in high school. You know, so I was still interested in that, but I didn't really think I was going to pursue that as a major area of study or as a career. And also, McGill hardly had any of that. There's one art history course. So it was things like philosophy and sociology, and they still had a Latin requirement then, and, you know, all of those things, languages and social sciences.
Oh, nice.
I was not a good student, though. I could get by high school getting pretty good marks, but, you know, I had trouble concentrating. And so then when I got to college, I passed most of my courses, but my marks weren't good, and I don't think I was that interested. So then after 3 years, I then transferred to Sir George Williams. I did that to study painting and drawing, and I loved that. You know, in New York, my art teacher, the one I related most with, had studied with Robert Motherwell, who was one of the major abstract expressionists who believed in just letting it happen, don't preconceive anything, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I loved that. And, you know, that one course at McGill wasn't like that. But then when I got to Sir George Williams, you know, it was very easy to do that. You know, the painting courses were very free, and this was the late 60s, so everything was very free. That was a very good experience for me.
Going to post-secondary during the late 60s seems like it would be a really fun time.
Yes, for me it was. I'd say that my gayness was totally repressed then. I did tell people about it sometimes, but, you know, it was very compartmentalized, I'd say. Both at McGill and at Sir George Williams, I went to see the school psychiatrist and would mention it. But and at that time, you know, the mid-60s, late-60s, you know, people would say, you know, once you had relationships with women, you'd find that you're okay, and you shouldn't assume that your homosexuality is there forever. And you know, I just went with that. I figured, okay, why not? Why not believe it? And this is what they were telling me. And even the psychiatrist in the Bronx that I really, really, really liked, finally, he was the one who helped me with my phobias and made them go away. This was 1964, when I was 15, 16. You know, he was a pretty cool guy, but even he was saying, no, he doesn't think that I'm really homosexual, but that I just have very strong heterosexual inhibitions. Jumping forward to, let's see, summer of 64. I was in New York that summer, you know, working, you know, had a summer job, and it was near Washington Square, Greenwich Village, and I would eat my lunch there and on the bench. And, you know, New Yorkers, a lot of them are they're really real characters, especially then. Then more than now, I think. So one of these characters came up to me and he said, "Hi, sweetheart." And I was a little bit taken aback. But, you know, I let him talk. I try to be pretty open, I think. And even though I found him kind of gruff and maybe a little bit offensive, as many New Yorkers are. Everything he was telling me, thinking back on it, was spot on. Right away, he sensed my gayness. And I said, oh, but this psychiatrist was telling me that I'm not really gay, and it's just my inhibitions. So he says to me, look, kid, your mommy and daddy are paying for this, and how do you think that they're going to feel it if you tell them that their son is gay? So, you know, that got me to thinking.
And, he sounds like an interesting character and maybe a good judge of character himself.
Very good judge of character. As he got to know me a bit, he said that I'm just about the most isolated person that he'd ever met. And I could see that, too. I mean, that's not true, of course. I mean, I've known many people who are more isolated than me. But I knew exactly what he was talking about, though.
Is this sort of because you live a lot of your life in your mind?
Yeah. I think especially that, at that time, I was thinking, what am I supposed to say to people? What do I say? What do I do? I lived so much of my life in my mind and constantly uptight about how to act and what to say. But a lot of it is that I just don't find it that easy to make friends. I have a few, but it gained great, and it's kind of nice. I have some good experiences with that. You know, it's hard for me to make friends. The friends I do have, it's just like a miracle. I think I'm a little bit offbeat and not mainstream, and when it happens, it happens. And I never know when it's going to happen and with whom. It's just, I can't force it. When I try to make a friend or try to get into a romantic relationship, usually it doesn't work. It usually happens when the other person decides that they want to be friends with me. It's just how it goes with me, it seems.
I can kind of relate to that myself. I think a lot of the friends that I have are my friends because they are very enthusiastic about being my friend. What do your friendships look like, the ones that work? What kind of dynamics do you find you usually experience?
Every one of them is different, I think. One of them I've known for many years. She's a straight woman. She's 77 now. Oh my goodness, I've known her for decades. I guess we met maybe in 1980. How long ago is that? 40 some odd years. We've had our periods of estrangement over the years. And so I think maybe we've both matured a bit over the past while. So we've gotten along pretty well. And what's it like? She's an artist. When I was more of an artist, I think that's what attracted her to me, both socially and I think romantically as well, although I never really got into that with her. But and she's funny. Anyway, the kind of relationship we have now is just friendly. And she at the beginning, she really wanted me to get back into drawing and painting. But I don't know, especially in the last maybe 10 years or so, I was working on something and I hit a snag. And in the meantime, I'd been very interested in Yiddish. I was taking some online Yiddish courses piped in from New York.
Cool.
I loved that.
Are you fluent?
Oh, no, not at all. But I've gotten a lot better. I can read Yiddish stories, so I'm still interested in that. I've actually, in a very small way, I've been trying to get back into art because this woman friend I was talking about said that it completes me somehow. It seems to complete my personality, you know, the art. And I know exactly what she means. I don't think I can explain it exactly, but it just seems to bring out something in me, which should be pursued, perhaps. But I've been telling people, it's harder now. It's now that I'm older, because I'm 73 now. I'm doing everything so much more slowly. And just to get things in order, get the dishes done, get myself showered once in a while, moving about, getting dressed in the morning, everything is just so much slower. And there's so much more of an emphasis on survival, just plain survival right now, that you know, maybe I'll find the time and headspace to get back into art. But, you know, it's more complicated than it was when I was younger. Talking about this friend of mine and connecting it to gayness. A few years ago, when I was still living in New Brunswick, St. John, New Brunswick, and it's a whole other story.
Yeah, when did you move to New Brunswick? Why did you move to New Brunswick? Were you there with anyone? What? Please tell me.
I lived in Montreal on and off for decades until 2007. At that point, there was a very strong anti-Israeli feeling in Quebec, most strong within the French-speaking community. And the way I saw it was often conflated with negative feelings about Jews in general. And right or wrong, it made me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And just at that same time, it was followed by a lot of anti-Jewish feeling about Jewish schools and the Hasidim infringing on other people's rights, so their French-speaking neighbors thought. And right or wrong, I just thought, maybe this is a good time for me to try something different. So at that time, like in the early 2000s, I was thinking, I'm retired now, and because I retired very early. Not that I had that much money. It was like on a shoestring budget, but I could do it. And so I was thinking, where do I want to go? Back to New York? I love New York. I like Canada better than the States, but I love New York. Mm-hmm. So that's a possibility. Should I just do something way out, like Holland, which I've always been interested in? All these possibilities, but they're all very expensive. New York costs a fortune. I wouldn't be able to receive all of my Canadian, social benefits either. So then finally I was thinking, where in Canada can I go? Toronto costs a fortune. Vancouver costs a fortune. Where would I want to go? There are the prairies and the Maritimes. I was thinking I probably like the Maritimes better than the prairies. So I took a trip there anyway. But so I took this trip to visit different cities in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. So I visited about a dozen different cities because I didn't want a car. At first I was thinking Halifax, but Halifax is also fairly expensive, and I didn't hate it, but I didn't like it that much. And also some of the other college towns like Antigonish and Wolfville, Truro, not a college town really, although they have the agricultural school in New Brunswick. There was Sackville, which is a beautiful little place. So the big three in New Brunswick are, of course, Moncton, Fredericton, and St. John. And I like St. John for lots of different reasons. Late 2006, I moved to St. John. I didn't believe I did it, but I did it. I was there for 8 years, until about 2015.
Nice.
I liked it there. I liked it a lot. And in St. John, there's a gay community there. There's both a Jewish community and a gay community. The gay community is really nice. Like everybody else in St. John, most everybody else, I met some real stinkers, but most of the people there are very, very nice. And gay pride was a lot more fun there for me.
Really?
Because Montreal is just so huge. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, the pride parade and the pride rally is like a family affair. Everybody, you know, these people who didn't know I was gay, and they just come out, you know, they line the streets to cheer.
That sounds nice.
Yeah.
Are you okay?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't mind crying. I think crying is a good thing, so I'm okay. You know, it really does choke me up now to think about that warm response from the neighbors.
Have you experienced much homophobia in your life, maybe earlier on?
As an effeminate teenager, oh, for sure. I mean, ninth grade, horrible experience. Nobody called me a homo. They'd say I'm a fairy. Yeah, that was a big word there, fairy and faggot. You don't say fairy too much anymore. At that time, those were the two biggies. And it was a horrible, horrible, horrible year. I mean, for, you know, being bullied, never physically, just verbal bullying. A lot of it was, you know, I was telling you that I was always thinking in terms of, what can I say? What can I do? That was a big, big thing. What do I say to people? And, you know, it doesn't come out right. It can come out obnoxious. It can come out awkward. It just makes you say things that you don't want to say, and you say it in a way that I didn't want to say, or in a way that I didn't want to say, and that would constantly be happening.
Yeah, it can be a big source of regret when you start pushing yourself, because then you're not really being yourself. And I think any time that we're not being ourselves, that can cause regret. That's
right. So it's constant regret, constantly being insulted for being so obnoxious. And I finally got out of it and, you know, met a whole lot of very interesting, very good people at university. I think finally one guy he actually became a therapist later, a wonderful person. He told me, Bobby, just be yourself. Just be yourself. Somehow he did it in a way that spoke to me, so.
Sounds like a really great guy.
He was a great guy. When I first got to McGill, when I just kind of got off the bus practically, I still was in this frame of mind of, what can I say? What can I do? Not so much what can I do, but what can I say? What interesting thing can I say to people? Because that was the big thing. I have nothing to say, so what can I say? Right away, maybe within 2 weeks of my getting to Montreal, 1964, I was in Phillips Square, and I got picked up by this older gay man. And we were talking a bit, and he asked me to go back to his apartment. It was some basement apartment on St. Denis Street. I wish I could remember where exactly. I knew what was happening, and I really wanted to go with him, so I did. This was the first time that I ever was with a man. I was not even 17 yet, almost 17. So it wasn't even legal then. But I'd know from legal. I mean, I didn't even think of that. It wasn't positive. It wasn't so bad either. Speaking to my naivety, the way I imagined it was that I would give myself a hand job and he would give himself a hand job. It didn't even occur to me that he would be touching me. That's where my head was at. That's how little I knew.
So you must have been quite surprised.
Yeah, I was surprised. And then when it's over, he said, okay, it's finished. He started getting dressed, and I started getting dressed, and that was that. But he asked me for my number. I gave it to him. He called me once or twice after that. He asked me to see him again. I said, no, I don't think I want to. I'll give you $5. And I didn't even know that wasn't good money. But I said, no, I don't want that. I think at that time I was still thinking in terms of, oh, this is just a passing phase for me, and I can still do it with girls, and while I'm not going to reject or feel bad about my homosexuality, I'm really still looking to, you know, to get into a real, quote-unquote, relationship with a woman. I think that was it, that I was still thinking in those terms. Oh, but what I wanted to tell you, though, was that, you know, one of the reasons I did this, why I accepted this guy's overtures, was it was connected to this feeling I told you about of my thinking, everybody else is talking and I'm not talking. I don't have anything to say. Why am I not talking? This sounds so crazy to me now. I think it would sound crazy to just about anybody.
I think a lot of people would actually relate very much to what you're saying, because I think it's very common, and maybe even increasingly more common in youth today, that there's a lot of like anxiety around social situations and not knowing how to do them.
I didn't get to the crazy part yet.
Oh!
The ostensible reason for my doing this, for my, you know, going home with this guy, was I wanted to have an interesting experience to talk about. And I did it. You know, I was at the McGill residence, and I developed a little circle at that point, and had a few guys that I was hanging out with at that point. And I told them this. I think most men my age, most gay men my age, would never want to do that. But I wanted to do it. I was thinking, this is an interesting story that I could relate, that I could impart to them. What do you think of that? Is that a little bit crazy?
No, I don't think so at all.
So anyway, there was that. You know, nobody said that they were particularly shocked by this. They said, this is interesting. But there's this one guy, a straight guy, basically. Maybe he had some gay feelings. He wanted to know all about it. Well, why did you do it? What did you do? I actually loved that. I wanted that attention. I liked the fact that I had this interesting thing about me that... And he was the only one who really wanted to bring that out. And still, I was still thinking that, okay, it was just this one experience. It wasn't the real me.
Did you have like a coming out at any point, or a point where you really embraced that side of yourself?
Actually, for years now, I've known that. You know, I've known that I'm completely gay. I'm not even bi.
Was there very much experimentation in that process?
There was some. We tried it, and you know, it just didn't work.
The best thing is to be yourself, right? And not force anything.
And as far as coming out is concerned, you know, my father actually asked me if I was gay. This goes back to around 1982, 1983. And my father could be a real asshole. I couldn't say he was a bad father. But I think he and my mother, they sort of knew already, but he just wanted to, he asked me. So I said, yeah, I am.
In the 80s, how involved in the gay scene were you?
Mostly going to the baths.
Oh, what were the bathhouses like? I've never been in one.
No, you never went to ladies' night?
No, never. I didn't even know that they had ladies' nights. I didn't even really know that bathhouses were a thing until I moved here in 2015, actually, when you moved back.
I liked them. I loved them. Maybe I would still go today if I didn't have to wear orthotics. So
yeah.
I like the fact that, you know, it was lit, sometimes dimly lit, but lit. You know, you could see what was going on as opposed to, you know, in the middle of the night in La Fontaine Park or something. In the bath, you keep walking around and you bump into the same people again and again, and it's easier to talk a bit first. And it's just more of a situation which I'm better at. You know, you meet the person right in the shower or in the steam bath. And then I actually got to know, I actually made some friends through that. And so for me, it was a good experience. I thought it was a lot of fun. And now I don't know how I'd find it, because this is pre-internet. I have a feeling that today people would just expect certain things. Like if you look at porn sites, first there's oral sex, and then there's anal sex. When I was going to the baths in the 80s mostly, if you just wanted to cuddle, if you just wanted to give somebody a hand job, and vice versa, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think today that wouldn't be enough.
Well, I think that you're right in that porn depictions of sex generally are very formulaic. I think a lot of people do get shaped by the porn that they watch.
Yeah.
And I really hope that they question these things and that they learn a little bit beyond that and realize that, you know, relationships and encounters can be all sorts of different ways of being and different actions.
My sex life now is really, it's very quiet now. It's mostly my fantasies. I don't have sex with anybody. I have one gay friend who, he's funny. He said, you know, he's French speaking, so he says, je t'aime. And in French, you know, aimé is vague. It means I like you, I love you. And in his case, he means a little bit of both. He doesn't have too many gay friends, and so he likes the fact that I'm gay. I ask him, why do you like me or love me? Pourquoi tu m'aimes? And he says, suis une personne d'amour. We speak mostly French. You know, my French is broken, but so with him, it's basically he's just a friend. It's mostly just hugging. He's a hugger. I say it's a relationship more than just a platonic relationship. And so this guy is the closest thing to a boyfriend I have now.
Well, it sounds like a nice, comforting relationship.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
Thank you for listening to the Gay and Grey Montreal podcast. This episode was recorded over Zoom and edited by myself, Nikki Machen.
You need quality sounds? Tune into CKUT 90.3 on the Frequency Modulation Band Radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information. CKUT.
Welcome to the Gay and Grey podcast.
All right, so I am here with Montreal Council of Women's Woman of the Year, Miranda.
2021. Yes, thank you for coming to that, by the way. I just started reviewing it, and I'm still catching up on the comments that were in the chats. And
it was so nice.
So I'm glad. I didn't realize you were there.
And also, you don't really like to have a whole lot of attention on yourself.
No.
You are the co-founder of Gay and Grey Montreal. How did Gay and Grey come into being?
Bruce came to me. I got hired out of school. I went back in 2012 to Vanier to do special care counseling program, which had always been my plan since high school. But you know how things get rerouted. Mm-hmm. So I went back in 2012 and did that. And when I finished the program, Prevention Côte des Neiges NDG was hiring the first outreach worker for 55 plus for the NDG area. They'd had one for Côte des Neiges for several years, but they saw a need for NDG. And so they were, a lot of the main organizations had gotten together and developed a group that applied for funding, trying to get someone there. Finally, it happened. And I think I was just a few months in, and Bruce was one of my key partners because he was still running Clean Sweepers Coupe de Belay at that mm-hmm. time, which is one of our partners. And he approached me with this idea. And we just worked on that. So he's been really, you know, doing most of the legwork. But I'm on the board, and I participate wherever I can. At the beginning, I was going to a lot of the activities in the past year. And then funding came, and then we were able to hire you. And then it's just been gradually growing. So it's great. It's a need. It's, I think, going to be a greater need, as we're going to see. And I'm really happy to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. And you said that you brought in your mom as a key effort to bring in more women into the group.
Well, to get her feedback on that, because she was very active in the community and when I was growing up, and was one of the co-founders of the Gay Line, which no longer exists on the English side, at least as it was. And a few of our members are people I grew up under that my mom was working with or in some capacity. So there's a lot of full circle linkage there.
Yeah.
That my mom's been separated from the community for a while, so she couldn't be as active as you were in recruitment, obviously.
Well, yeah, it's hard to stay connected because a lot of the resources are really geared towards youth.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we age, it's more essential to stay connected and more difficult to do so. What was it like when you were growing up and you know, your mom started Gay Line, and what was it like for you? How old were you when all that was happening?
I was very young. I mean, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7,
mm-hmm.
8. My mom, she had my upbringing on quite a roller coaster ride. The beginning was kind of scary in a lot of ways because I had to lie a lot. So there was always this mixed emotion of you're not supposed to lie, but then I'm told to lie because her girlfriends had to be the roommates, you know. I had to lie about who they really were. Everyone was an auntie. How many aunties can a person have, for God's sake? and or the roommate. If they were living together, then it was that's the roommate to share the rent, because fortunately everyone knew how poor we were. So that worked. And my grandmother was a Jehovah's Witness. Well, this is 70s too, so it was very much more intense than it is now, the religion as a whole. And my grandmother was younger, so much more aggressive than she was as she mellowed out. So it was always the big secret to make sure she didn't find out anything, because at that time she could have gotten custody of me, you know, it would have been easy. And so there was always these interviews my mother would have with me, like, who do you want to live with? Who would you want to live with if you can't live with me? And so, you know, there was a lot of fear put in and saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. But then she'd send me to school with stuff that people would kind of question, you know, like, I don't need balls to play on my frisbee, you know, like, why couldn't I just have a regular baseball like the other kids, you know? So I learned to adjust to that and conform and do the lying and stay well behaved as much as possible.
What lessons do you think you got because of how you grew up that other people don't seem to have gotten, or maybe to a lesser degree?
Well, I grew up much more exposed, so more open-minded, obviously, you know, about LGBT stuff in the 70s, single parent life, poverty. You know, I was poor in a very rich neighborhood, which is messed up too, but it was a fun neighborhood, but you know, there was always those challenges, being the only poor one, the only black person of color, and a single parent home. But that gave, you know, taught me a lot, learned a lot. My mom did stuff that was very important to society, but it was very dangerous for me and put me at risk, like having the shelter in our home. People don't want to kill their wives, you know, just put a kid in the mix. but still, that made me sensitive to that issue, which a lot of people weren't at 5 and 6 years old, you know. So I'm grateful for that. And in my schooling, I was very able to share that exposure in a bit, because my mother made sure we did that, you know, with the not letting anything sexist pass or anything racist pass. She'd be down there front and center. So it was embarrassing at the time, but now I do it and my daughter does it, right? So
you've learned how to speak up when you need to.
Well, it was hard too, because my mother is a powerhouse. So she also had, I had a fear of authority for the longest time, so I couldn't speak up. So it worked against me in a lot of ways. So I feared authority, so I wouldn't stand up for myself. My mother would if she thought it was appropriate if I happened to tell her, but I would not. And that was the problem, like with sexual abuse, you know, she would leave me alone with the abuser, but he was the great grandfather. You did what you were told to do, or there were consequences, and I never liked the consequences, so I was a very obedient child. But I was able to rationalize everything as well, too, at a young age. So even at 3, with the great-grandfather pervert, I had it rationalized in my head that I knew the grandmother had died, he didn't have a wife, he was lonely, I was fulfilling a service. I was fulfilling a need. So I never had the trauma a lot of people have with sexual abuse at all. And I know, because I've been in classrooms with students where that was the topic, and they, you know, they're triggered and they're screaming and crying in the classroom, because we would have to do these tests where they would like put out cologne, we'd be blindfolded, a zipper, you know, they would do all these triggers, and I'd be fine, because to me, I was always the helper. I wasn't being the victim. So that's how I got through that aspect of things.
Sounds like you have a very like resilient oriented approach to things.
It seems to happen. And when the littlest thing that you think would be easy is when I would probably crack over that.
That's something that I found was like the first sort of symptoms of my own like sort of dealing with trauma was when, you know, I would crack my egg yolk and I would be a mess on the floor because I had bottled so much up that like, you know, that one little thing was enough to just like break whatever was in there. And it was because it was a safe situation, you know, I wasn't in a traumatic situation at that moment. So then it was safe to like let some of that out. And at the time I had no idea why, like it didn't make sense to me at all. And it took a long time to like realize that when you don't deal with your trauma, it comes out in ways that are unexpected and maybe less directly.
Or you redirect it.
Exactly.
It's easier to cry, you know, when Princess Diana died than when my grandmother did. You know what I mean? It's like, that's horrible, you know, because it's easier to focus on and things like that.
Yeah, or, like yeah, watching movies to get you to cry.
Exactly, yeah. Like lately, I've been crying and stuff. I would never, but I have, there's the hormone issue. I don't know how much of it's the hormones with the perimenopause and everything happening. But, and then I also was, I've been laughing hysterically at things I normally don't. I laughed at Seinfeld all weekend, hysterically. And I can't stand that show because they're not nice people. And I don't like anybody on that show, but I was laughing like hysterical. I'm like, okay, someone's all right here.
Well, I mean, it's been a stressful year, right? And when we're really stressed out, you know, it can come out in all sorts of ways. And I had learned that laughing when you're uncomfortable is a way of releasing that discomfort. And I think a lot of people learn that. And so laughing, crying, they're both releases that can be really, really helpful with dealing with stress.
Went to Mind High School, which was in the same building as FACE. And it was a very alternative high school at the time in the 80s. Came out of the 70s. You learned at your own pace. You booked your own classes and what have you. And it was a very hippie kind of school. Rufus Wainwright and the McGarrigle sisters, a lot of artists' kids were there. So it was really like progressive and hippie-like and really cool. And most of the school was gay. And I'm like, all right, I fit. This is going to be so cool. My mother gets married to a man and has a baby.
You feel so betrayed.
Oh, man, not
like
even.
The one time that this
I would have
paying
this
off.
All, yeah, exactly. Yeah, the timing was just too. So it was, that was a rough year because it was just a very rough year. But anyway, so yeah, so those are kind of the things that it was.
Well, it's tough because I think people are still grappling with the idea of bisexuality, you know, and also many other reasons why you might marry a man. So when people think like, oh, well, they're gay, then they immediately assume all sorts of other things about someone that may not be true, but there's these really rigid ideas that everybody else holds on to that would really deeply impact you as a child of someone in the gay community.
Yeah, no one knew. I mean, in my immediate world, you couldn't.
Ooh.
I mean, but I already stuck out as the only kid of color on the block, the only single parent home, only kid on welfare. So I had a lot of not being able to be dressed properly. So walking, I was the only one walking 20 minutes to school, walking 20 minutes home for lunch because my mom couldn't afford the lunch program. The lunch monitors had to be paid to keep an eye on you.
What?
And my mother couldn't afford that, so I was the kid that walked back and forth at lunch. But on these snowstorm days, and especially since I didn't have proper clothing, because we were that poor, literally that poor, then the teacher would say, here's a dollar, I'm going to call your mom, you're going to stay. You can't do that walk, like it's a blizzard, you know. There was a strong sense of unity among women I had never known. I mean, that's all I knew. I had an incident with an ex-girlfriend of a close friend of mine who was just brutal, like, because she was so insecure and jealous of me. I'd never had a woman retaliate against me. I mean, when you saw a woman, that was an ally. Like, they were never going to hurt you or harm you or betray you. I'd never been around such an insecure woman who was, like, brutal and very traumatizing. And I had faced a huge public humiliation, which was traumatizing. But she opened my eyes to watch out for insecure women. But growing up, you always felt safe. It was a village. There was all these great women who were around to help raise me or be there for me. And then I was in that play. I was in last summer at Bluefish Cove, which was one of the first gay productions to be put on in Montreal. Jackie Lemoyne was a play director. and she really was the one who paved the way to have this done. And I was 12. So I was actually being babysat by her a lot. I was very close with her, and my mom was always doing stuff, so I spent a lot of time with her. And so when she was making this play, I was at every rehearsal. And it was huge, because as I said, it was one of the first plays to be done. It was at Calixa La Vallée, a theater in La Fontaine Park. It was 1982. I was starting high school in September at Montreal West High, which is now Royal West Academy. And this was like June, July that it was being launched. All the media was on it. And one of the characters drops out of the play. And I know all the lines because I've been at every rehearsal. So now this 12-year-old who's starting high school is now playing a 40-year-old lesbian woman of two college students. Penny Lang, who's like one of the, she rest in peace, but was one of the biggest folk singers in Canada, in Montreal, at the Yellow Door. She was my lover.
Oh my goodness. What was that like?
And my mom was concerned because I'd be starting high school, and, you know, so all the media, they weren't allowed to use my last name, just like my mother was.
Goodness.
My mother was always in the media, but hid, you know, in a hidden form.
You were a star.
The baby powder in my hair. Yeah, because I wanted to do it. I knew it. Like, and so I'm helped. Yeah. Like, I need to help. They need me. And I knew all the lines, so.
It was really fun?
Well, it was a lot for, you know, I'm on summer vacation. I'm about to start high school. It was like a 10-day run. So I was living at the theater. No, it was a big, big production. I still remember one line. Because someone uses the C word, and I think Penny Lang does, and I said, and the line I still remember was, as a feminist, I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't use a woman's genitalia as a derogatory word. Hell 12 yes. years old. Playing a 40-year-old lesbian. Yeah. So it was very interesting upbringing. Hard as hell, but I would, you know, I am one of the most open-minded people I know, and have been around a lot and seen a lot, so.
Yeah, it can be frustrating being, like, one of the more progressive people that you know, because you're kind of constantly educating everyone around you and calling things.
My mother's good friend, they were pregnant at the same time, so I was born in June, and her son, Sadiq, was born in September, and so we kind of grew up together, and she was Austrian. And she decided to leave the city, and her and her husband bought land, lived up in the Eastern Townships. And he was a log cabin builder, and she was a weaver, and they were vegans. And no TV. Like, it was like, and so Sadiq went to this free school in Richford, Vermont. And so my mom caught wind of it and thought this would be a great thing for me to do. So for grade two, I had done Mackay Center. I was one of the first kids to do the reverse integration program.
What's the reverse integration program?
Where they would have neurotypical or non-disabled people, kids join the classes with the handicap, so to do community sensitization. And so I think I was like the second year to do it. I loved it. It was the best year of my life. I did it for grade two, and there was such a waiting list I couldn't stay. But I loved it. It was the best year of elementary school in my life. But then what do? Throw me back in the regular system. My mom knew that wouldn't work. So now I'm shipped off to this live with the Buddhists. And in the Eastern Townships, literally now I'm really the only kid of color anywhere to be found. And I think it would have been better.
With the Buddhists? Were there any Asian kids?
The Buddhists, because I was very attached to my mother. I don't know if you've met her, but she's...
I have.
Yes.
I have.
So I had a very normal bond with her. She was a single mom. There'd been a lot of trauma, so... And all of a sudden, now I'm shipped out. But I was going home every weekend. And I think if they had really stuck through it and just left me there till Christmas, but I would just adjust by Wednesday. Friday, I would be back in Montreal West. I'd be back in NDG. Sunday night, driven back. And I think that the back and forth was too much. So I'd get back on Sunday night and I'd be bawling again because I'd miss my mom. And I'd cry and cry. And they're Buddhists. You're not supposed to cry. So they'd be like...
What do you mean you're not supposed to cry?
Oh, no,
I didn't know this was Buddhist.
Well, these Buddhists,
Because
there is that sort of like separation.
There's no arguing. They lived in a 2x4 trailer, and their wedding vows were they would never have a fight. My mother yells.
What do you mean they would never have a fight?
Yeah, you don't fight. There's no arguing.
How do you deal with conflict?
They don't have it. It just doesn't
exist.
What do you
mean they don't have
conflict? Yeah, it doesn't exist. I can't explain it. I'm just telling you that my mother had the same reaction you did, but had to scream it at the wedding. What the fuck are you talking about? This makes no sense, these wedding vows. So their friendship ended. Okay. But before that, yeah, so they, yeah, no, there was never, no. Like, me crying was very disturbing to their environment that I missed my mother, and they wouldn't help me with it. It was like, go home. Hmm. You don't. They wouldn't console me. It was like, well, call your mother. She'll come and get you. And my mother's like, you've met my mother. I ain't coming to get her. I paid you. Staying there for the week. I even hid in the back of a car and got a lift back the same night. They didn't know where I went. I went and hid. I knew those people were driving back. Yeah. And my mother gets a call from the payphone. Don't worry, I'm in grade 3.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Anyway, the school was great. What's wild now is that all these years later, and I'm now 28, and my daughter's godfather invites me to his house in Vermont. His house is literally up the road from where my country school was in Vermont. So I lived in Mansonville. There was chickens and goats to tend to in the morning. Nothing was bought. Everything was handmade that we wore and natural. Vegan in 1976, 77, 78. And then we would be driven to Richford, Vermont to this free school. Because Sadiq really liked to learn. I loved school, but I didn't like math. Sadiq didn't like anything. So he won't. And they didn't force you to do anything. It was the 70s. It was a hippie school. They were growing pot, apparently, too. I didn't know. So they got busted. Huh? The school's gone now. But I would go, and I knew I had to do math. I knew it was not rational that I was getting away with not doing it. So I'd force them to teach me, like, 20 minutes of math. I think the whole year I was there, Sadiq, he had a crush on Anastasia. I came in to learn how to spell Anastasia. It was too complicated. Went back to the sandbox. So I never saw Sadiq in school. But every morning driven to Richford, Vermont, do this free school, learn at your own pace. Yeah, I had some good things happened there. But it was a weird experience. And then it was just too much on them because my being upset leaving my mother was too much. So I think in January I went back into the regular school system. Yeah, so that was interesting. I changed schools every year, pretty much. But, you know, we can kick you out after the first year, and, you know, that's right. And so after the first year, my mom hated it. So she brought me to Mind. But then I had all this too many changes. Changing of school, having to go downtown to school. My mother, now not a lesbian, but married to a man. There's now a man in my house. Then there's a baby. My mother was going to school at McGill, right across the street from me, and doing her school social work. So that was a huge change.
Yeah.
And
you were both going to school at the same time in the same place?
Well, she was across the street at McGill, and I was where Face is in the old school of Montreal, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I skipped. I ended up, I was just too traumatized with everything. And they made it easy because they ran it like a stage up. You had to show responsibility, and I just had none left. I just had been so responsible my whole life.
Yeah.
So, and my new stepfather was Croatian and they used to make this plum brandy called Slivovica. And I started drinking. That's when I started bringing Mickey's, skipping school and hanging out at a cafe where I would write depressing poetry. And then
adolescent experience.
And then the people, because we had, it was run like a stage up, so there was always someone at the Potagerie because they would be on a break.
Yeah.
So I always had someone coming to hang out with, and I just skipped, and then my mother showed up for parent-teacher interviews, like, she hasn't been here for 3 months. And they don't call because it's up to you. That's sorry.
Very convenient.
Yeah, very convenient. Very convenient. But just, it was a great school, but just not for me at my mental state of time. But that's when I hung out with the McGarrigles, you know, Kate and Anna's niece, Rufus and Martha's cousin. They lived right near the school in St. Famille, so Janie, you know, that was a fun household. You can only imagine. So I had some cool friends who took me in when I'd be running away all the time. My mother was an activist, so everything was, if I wasn't in school, I was at a meeting or I was on a board or, you know, I was on my first board of directors at 16 for Head and Hands.
That's at 16.
I was the first youth rep at 16, 17. I was vice president of the board.
Well, well done.
But, so, you know, and I was always working and volunteer or fighting for some cause. So I wasn't hanging out at the snack bar like my friend. I hung out at snack bar waiting for the bus to get me to my next job, you know, so I'd be like there half an hour or whatever. But I worked, and then I had my brother at 14, so when I wasn't working or in school, I was raising him. Yeah. I had 30 families I babysat or cleaned house for, because my mother never gave me money, so if I needed money, I had to do it on my own. So 16, 17, I was literally in burnout. Because I had a 3-page CV already at 16. Marcos and Pepe's opened this place in Westmount. It was the first bar, real bar we had with cheap drinks and music, and it was fun. And I just started partying. So when everyone was finishing their partying or, you know, had climaxed within the party mode and was thinking about their future, I had just seen it. I was like, and then learned how alcohol could self-medicate.
Yeah.
So then for those years I was partying at Marcos every day. It was like my life. But I still had a brother to take care of, and I was still working, and I was going to Dawson and working 3 jobs. And by 17 I had my own apartment because I was kicked out.
Whoa.
My mother kicked me out at 16 and a half. Grandparents, they were poor as shit, but they used to dance at the Savoy in New York with Billie Holiday and all that. So they would come home, and my grandmother, perfect pitch for whistling. So they got to learn about Escape Through the Jazz music, and so him and my uncle were quite big musicians back in the day. My father came up as Chubby Checker's band leader. That's how he met my mom. That's why I'm born. That's why he came to Montreal. So, but he played with Gladys Knight and the Pips and all of that. Well, I mean, where I come from in Jersey is all the musicians, Whitney Houston. My grandmother's buried right next to Whitney Houston. When I went to her grave, I have to go through security. There's a security guard because now Bobby Christina's over here. But there's my grandmother and here's Whitney at the cemetery.
Have there been moments in your work with Gay and Gray that you've just really felt like, this makes it all worth it?
Oh, every day. Yeah, in all my work, for sure. There's always an aspect. I wouldn't get up and do it. I wouldn't get up in the morning if there wasn't an aspect, for sure. I also saw, when I started, was fairly new in the job, and I was at an HLM, or the social housing for seniors, and I ran into someone from my childhood that was a friend of my mom's who I knew was in the LGBT community. And she panicked when she saw me and asked me not to say anything. So I saw firsthand the fear. And she told me she was in a group, but they met privately at different people's homes. They rarely met in restaurants or even in public places. Unfortunately, since Gay and Gray's been launched, I haven't been able to find her. So I haven't been able to tell her about it, but yeah.
Would you like to speak more about the barriers for this age group, this part of this demographic, that makes it especially challenging to really meet up and support one another?
Well, then it's compounded too, because you have the ageism, so you're already feeling invisible. Mm-hmm. If you're of LGBT group, your network's a bit smaller, your resources are a bit smaller. You add Indigenous or race onto that. And then being in Quebec, you add the language component. I mean, you're down to like a very, very small space. And if I'm still correct in understanding, I think we're the only Anglophone LGBT group on island, is my understanding, for older adults. So that says it right there.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to other cities, and there's a lot of them. You know, there's not one group. It makes sense it would be an NDG too, because NDG has always been a real grassroots movement neighborhood. A lot of organizations that still exist today were, you know, started by members of our group, even members, you know, neighborhood people from the 70s, 60s and 70s that are still standing today. So it makes sense that it would start here as well, Gangrene, right in the heart of where things start when it comes to resources and community support, with NDG being, you know, next to Westmount and Côte Saint-Luc, predominantly Anglophone areas. A lot has launched the Food Depot, which is, you know, has been the model for other area, for other institutions on the island. The NDG Community Council is 80 years old. The Seniors Council is 45 years old. You know, prevention's 40 years old.
Young at heart, for it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young. Thank you.